Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. Here, we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of professionals actively working on the front lines in the field of food addiction. The purpose of our show is to educate you, the listener, and increase overall awareness about food addiction as a disease with abstinence as the solution. Here, we talk about all things recovery. Most importantly, how to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make a change for yourself, tell others about your change, and hopefully the message will spread.
Hey there, Food Junkies listeners. Today we speak with Dr. Carrie Anderson. Dr. Carrie Anderson has positioned herself as a respected clinician and leader in the field of eating disorders. Her career spans over three decades of leading treatment teams in all levels of care. Carrie has developed several treatment models, most recently for the treatment of binge eating. Carrie earned her Doctor of Behavioral Health with her research project, The Mindful Eating Cycle, Treatment for Binge Eating Disorder at Arizona State University in 2012. Co-creator of the Am I Hungry? Mindful Eating for Binge Eating program, Carrie also co-authored the acclaimed book, Eat What You Love, Love What You Eat for Binge Eating, a mindful eating program for healing your relationship with food and your body. Her memoir, Food, Body, and Love, But the Greatest of These is Love, was released in 2021. This work digs deeper into the science behind effective treatment and includes research in food addiction and issues faced in obesity medicine. She is an adjunct faculty for the University of New Hampshire and trains graduate students in treatment methods for eating disorders. As a licensed therapist in three states and certified eating disorder specialist and supervisor, Carrie maintains a private practice in Scottsdale, Arizona. Today, Clarissa and I talk with Carrie about her personal and professional journey, all about binge eating disorder, polyvagal theory and the role of vagal circuitry in food and eating behavior, using a harm reduction model when treating binge and loss of control eating. Carrie shares about the Safe and Sound protocol. We ask her about food addiction. Carrie shares about her book and workbook, and she answers our signature question. Welcome, Dr. Carrie Anderson.
Okay, well, thank you so much for being with us, Carrie. We really appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I've heard about your podcast and have listened to a few of your episodes. So I find it really special to be able to be invited and be a guest.
Yeah, well, thank you. And so we always just like to start off with the personal. So do you identify as a person with an eating disorder? And was there an aha moment for you? And can you tell us about how you got then, like how that translated into working in the field and that progression?
Well, I had an eating disorder as a teenager and into my young adulthood, but I didn't really know that I had an eating disorder at the time. See, this was in the 70s, the late 70s, and I just was one hot mess, really, of a teenager. So I thought that I just was a failed dieter. I thought that I couldn't control myself. I couldn't stay on a diet. And as soon as I would be very successful on a diet, I was one of those that could be really rigid in terms of, you know, checking all the boxes. I was one of the first Weight Watcher success stories, right? I was going to be a lifetime member. So when I was on a diet, I was really on a diet. And when I was off a diet, I was a mess. I was off and I was binging my brains out and I was eating things and doing things that were really humiliating. And so I do speak about a lot of those stories in my memoir that I wrote, but I do come at this from a place of having had an eating disorder. I don't identify as having one now. So I do believe that people can recover. I'm not one of those that's always recovering. It doesn't mean that I'm not vulnerable to any type of old habit, right? So I interchange disorder with addiction, with habits, you just put in the words and they work for me. But anyway, and so that is what drives my passion for working with this population. I finally got treatment in my late 20s. I had become in fitness and the wellness field. I was an athletic director at a small women's college in Los Angeles, and I was a mess. And it's no surprise that I went into nutrition and fitness because I was obsessed with it. And so I did get treatment. And back then, we actually treated eating disorders. My treatment was 12-step based. It was an addiction model. I think that it's what I needed at the time. So I went back to school and became a wounded healer, right? And so I got my master's and then I've only been in the eating disorder field since. So that's what I've done. And I later on at age 50, I went back and got my doctorate. And so I've worked in treatment centers. I've worked in all different levels, residential treatment centers. I've worked in intensive outpatient. And then I've been in private practice for about 10 years now.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for sharing that with us, Carrie. I'm wondering if you can speak to, we've certainly talked on the show about other eating disorders, but we haven't talked that much about binge eating disorder. And it's often experienced by a lot of our clients with, you know, food addiction struggles or disordered eating. And, you know, I've heard you say binge eating disorder is one of the most undiagnosed, misunderstood, and undertreated of all the eating and feeding disorders. So can you tell us a little bit more about binge eating disorder and why you feel that way?
Well, binge eating disorder actually is the most common, but I think it's the most unrecognized. I wish that people recognized it more. Most people that have binge eating disorder don't identify as having an eating disorder, where somebody that is starving themselves or using compensatory behaviors, they do know they have an eating disorder. But many people, they wouldn't go to the Yellow Pages and say, oh, let me look up eating disorder therapist because that's what I need. And that's why I have such a heart for it, because I think that they don't realize that other people are struggling with the same things. They think that they're the one that just can't get it together. We know where they show up. They show up in the surgeon's offices, right? They show up in now to get their shots, their semaglutides. They show up in weight loss centers because most of them feel that it's, you know, that they're just a failed dieter and that they can't control their food. Also, many, many feel that they're addicted to food. And I believe that, and I know we'll get to this, but I do believe that about a third or more of people with binge eating disorder actually have a food addiction. And so it's just some just, you know, have a little bit of each mixed together, but essentially they're not looking for it. And that's why it's not treated, because people don't identify it, right? They'll go and they'll treat what they think is the problem, which is the weight. They think it's a weight disorder. Okay. And that's what most medical field looks at. And they do, they even consider them weight disorders. And I've even had many people in the public health field that think that, you know, well, you know, so what if they treat their binge eating disorder, if they're still fat, and I'm using quotes here, if they're still fat, then they didn't treat the problem. Because people today and still in the health field and in our culture believe fat's the problem. And so that's why it's not recognized, or, you know, they don't understand that they're not looking at the symptom. Right? That's the symptom. That's not the problem. So that's how I conceptualize that and why people aren't getting help. And so I have such a passion that I go to those. I mean, I work with some weight loss centers in the Phoenix area where my practice is, in Scottsdale. I work with bariatric surgeons. I go to where the people are. Now, I've been judged for that in the eating disorder world. Like, I am crossing over and I'm, you know, I'm promoting the thin ideal, and yet I'm just looking for people that need to hear the truth and need to hear the message, and that there's a way out of this.
And I imagine you're probably also educating some of these weight centers on the symptoms to look for. You know, I think that, again, it makes perfect sense. We find the same in the food addiction world, right? It's like, that is, people don't know about food addiction, and therefore it's like, oh, what if there was another cause of what was going on? And then there could be a treatment, right?
And I always talk about, this is not, everybody thinks, they use the term, and I used to use the term all the time, emotional eating. And so that this was an emotional issue. The thing that I'm wanting to shout from the rooftops is, this is a neurological, biological, this is a science issue. There are, you know, sure, we are trying to regulate our nervous system with food, and it works very effectively. But this really isn't for people that have emotional problems. I mean, this isn't something that, you know, and that, I think that's misunderstood.
Can you talk a bit about that? Because you said it's like misunderstood and it's undertreated. Can you, so for listeners who are listening, especially like Clarissa was saying, we often work at that intersection. So many of our clients have, you know, both things going on. And so maybe that would be helpful if we could hear, you know, what might help us recognize this could also be, or it is, binge eating disorder.
Right. Well, binge eating disorder, it's been treated for years as a psychological problem. And that if we could self-regulate, emotional regulation, and sure, some of the most evidence-based treatments for binge eating disorder have in place ways to learn to manage their nervous systems, right? And to manage their stress levels and whatnot, because it really does, from a psychological issue, it works well, right? To numb out and to check out and to go away. Just take me away. It really is a dissociative disorder, interestingly, right? It's a way to dissociate. And so at the same time, what people don't understand, it's equally a way to manage the nervous system in the sense that it will pull us from a sympathetic fight flight system and move us. In fact, you know, digestion really is a parasympathetic action of the autonomic nervous system. And interestingly, I'll speak a little bit more about the polyvagal theory, but what it also does is it can help us shut down and calm to the point of checking out. So it almost takes it too far, right? So that the intention is to pull us into a state of calm, right? And out of a fight, flight, sympathetic nervous system. But at the same time, when we overeat, it will plunge us into what we call a dorsal vagal, kind of a freeze and kind of a dissociative, a sleep or slumber. So we don't know when to stop, right? It's like because we overdo it. But that comes from also a survival mechanism. Why do we overdo it? Well, it's because our brain has food insecurity. Our brain thinks that we're not getting enough food. And so we continue to eat and eat out of a survival mechanism, right? And that's being pulled by some different mechanisms, such as from neurologically, it's wanting to calm the system down. From a habit situation, it's being driven by dopamine and burst of dopamine. And so that's what we're looking for in terms of a feel good and to kind of melt away kind of process. But we're also, all of our cravings for food are coming from our hormone situation, our blood sugar issues that are going on, from our gut microbiome. So we've got all these mechanisms from neurology to biology in the gut, in the bloodstreams, in the hormone balances, the dopamine balances, all of this type of thing is driving this behavior. And people just think they don't have willpower. But the thing is that our eating behavior, I would say 90% of our eating behavior isn't a conscious choice. In a slideshow that I have this whole mechanism of all the different factors that go into eating behavior. And the conscious aspects of it is very small in terms of making those decisions. And when I start to talk about this with the people that I treat, the shame just starts to fall off. And they go, you mean, you know, not my fault? You mean I'm not just a person that has no control? No, there's so many things that are driving this. And so once we understand that, and we can pinpoint that in the treatment, that those things can be corrected.
Yeah, thanks so much for speaking to the complexity of that, because I do think that that gets missed often and it does become this kind of moral failing, right? That we can't follow through with. I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about your doctoral dissertation on the treatment of binge eating disorder. So what did you find in the research that our listeners who may be struggling with binge eating disorder should know?
Well, actually, my doctoral dissertation was done, well, I graduated 13 years ago, so 14 years ago. And that was when we were using mindfulness in order to treat this disorder. I later started doing a lot of research on the other scientific mechanisms, which I got turned on to all that, especially the neurology and whatnot when I was in my doctorate. But my dissertation was actually about that. What we did find, which was really interesting, is that restriction or really restrictive diets makes this condition much worse. And that is when we found in our one-year follow-up. So what we found is that you can use mindfulness-based treatments. So that would be our DBTs, ACTs, this, you know, alphabet soup types of treatments. Okay. We know that because it is a dissociative disorder, and I just come right out and tell people that the whole mechanism of binge eating, it's not necessarily about pleasure after the very beginning of it. It really is about creating a process of going away and dissociating. Most of the eating, we don't even realize that we've eaten that much until we kind of wake up to, I'm out of food, right? Or the wrappers or whatnot. And so since it is the antithesis of dissociation is mindfulness, you cannot be mindful and dissociate at the same time. And that's why mindfulness really works. Now, many people that were in the program and the clinical trials and whatnot, they would actually come right out and say, I chose to be mindless. Totally get that. Okay. But if you engage in mindfulness, you also will be much less likely to fall into that dissociative state. And so that's what we use. We use mindfulness-based treatments. And so that was, we were shown that that type of treatment would correct. So people went from on the binge eating scales, which, you know, in many, we took a lot of different psychometrics, but the binge eating to scale was the one that people went from severe binge eating level to 12 weeks later to a non-binging state. And it could, you know, through using mindfulness, okay? 1 year later, they actually had even lower scores continuing to use these techniques. 1 year later, without treatment, they actually, when we redid the testing, they actually had lower scores. So it continues to work. So this was, we were just ecstatic, but there were some outliers. And the outliers, the ones that went back to binge eating, every single one of them went back to a restrictive diet. Now, at the time that we did this, HCG was a real big, I mean, the hormone shots. You know, I don't know if the hormones did anything, but I know the 500 calorie diet did. It's like, so says, I'm on hormones, I'm on HCG. And I go, okay, well, tell me a little bit more. Well, we eat 500 calories a day. And I go, okay, well, that makes sense. Now I understand why you're losing weight. But that was really an interesting thing. And we tried to do some more. Someone actually still has our raw data and is doing some more research with it, even, you know, 12 years later, to try to figure out a little bit more about what was happening with that. So I thought that was interesting.
It is interesting. So if you don't treat it with mindfulness now, or you know, I guess exclusively with mindfulness now, and I'm almost curious to know if you're treating it more like a dissociative order than a disorder than a feeding and eating disorder, you know, how do you treat your clients with binge eating disorder, if we can ask?
Yeah, actually, because I'm more of a, I'd use mindfulness techniques. In fact, my favorite is ACT therapy, although I'm most extensively trained in DBT. I was a DBT trainer for years. Back in the day when, you know, when I first started getting into DBT, I actually was able to train with Marsha Linehan in Seattle. So my DBT roots go deep. Okay. So it's hard sometimes for me to know, am I not doing DBT? Because it's just such a part of me, but I love ACT therapy. And so I do use mindfulness-based things in it, but I become much more body-based therapist. I really am body first. Okay. Now I've really kind of transitioned into a more, because I just think that our body experiences something and then our brain creates a story, makes up a story as to what's really going on. So if we can meet the body first, you know, and understand that all our brain's doing is making up stories about our body and what's really happening, then we understand that if we can befriend our body and we can take care of it in terms of making it feel safe. All my clients is, how can we make our body feel safe? Even to the point of, how do we feed it? Okay. And so, because I don't think binging makes the body feel safe at all. I think it's saying, what the heck? Like, you know, the pancreas is going, I'm trying as hard as I can. I'm pumping. It's like, I don't know what to do with all this food, because it's not natural and it's not normal. And so that puts the body in a state of fear. eating too little creates all kinds of fear. And I really talk a lot with my clients about food insecurity. And most all of my clients have a long history of food insecurity, whether it was something in childhood, infancy or childhood, or whether it was self-imposed with dieting behavior. There is a thread of food insecurity, which evokes a response, a binge eating response, because the body says, I'll take care of you. I'll make sure you don't die. So we look at all these different, so too little food causes fear in the body, too much food causes. And so I really work with people to help them create their own owner's manual of what foods does your body thrive on? How do you feel good and in what quantities and the types of foods? And so it's really about experimentation. And that's where the mindfulness comes in terms of really reading your body and listening to it. And it'll tell you, it will certainly tell you whether or not it likes something or it doesn't like something and what it thrives on. And that's only something that you can create. You can't say, well, I'm going to follow X, Y, and Z, you know, on TikTok and what they do, or this supermodel and what she does. You can only do it based on your own, befriending your own body and listening to what your body thrives on. Just absolutely. And so it really is an inside job for sure. So I even conceptualize that inflammation, and we know that inflammation is the number one cause of all of our disease and disorders, okay? And that's just the body that's afraid. I mean, inflammation is kind of like, you know, your big toe gets stubbed and it's throbbing and it gets red and puffy and whatnot. Okay, so that's inflammation. And it's saying, I'm trying to protect your toe. I'm trying to take care of it while we heal. And so you take that inflammation and you put it in any organ in the body or any place in the gut or whatnot. And it's just saying, something's not quite right here. And I'm just trying to take care of you because my whole job is to heal myself. That's what the body is. I'm going to heal myself. And so if we have inflammation, whether that be GERD, right? Or whether that be some sort of a, I'm not saying that people don't have, you know, some clear issues in terms of autoimmune disorders. And that's a whole nother, you know, thing. But from a basic concept, if something creates some pain or problem or inflammation in the body, then the body's just saying, I don't like it. I don't like it. And so can you do something different so I feel better? So if somebody is gluten sensitive, or if somebody is dairy sensitive, or if somebody is whatever, I don't roll my eyes like an eating disorder therapist. I don't say, that's your eating disorder talking. I hate that. That's that line. I hate that line more than anything. That's your eating disorder. No, listen to your body. And if your body says that, and you're truly, this is not a cognitive good food, bad food thing. This is a truly a body-based, my body just doesn't feel very good when I do that. Then experiment and try not having it for a while. And if your body thrives and you go, okay, thanks. I'm going to write that in my owner's manual. I talk too much. I'm sorry.
No, Dr. Anderson, you are speaking our language. We're both, the audience can't see us, but we're like nodding our heads and like high-fiving, like loving everything you're saying. I am wondering, because you mentioned ACT, which is acceptance and commitment therapy. And, you know, we haven't really talked a lot about it on our podcast. Would you be willing to share maybe like a practice or an exercise through like an ACT-based model that might help people understand how it could benefit them?
Yeah. Okay. So one concept is something called diffusion. And this has to do with, you know, those thoughts that the brain makes up. So oftentimes those might create, if we think about these things all the time, it creates kind of a belief systems and ways of thinking. So let's just say I'm wearing my glasses here, and I know that this is a audio, but what I'm doing is I'm wearing some sunglasses, and on the sunglasses, I've written some words. Now these were mine. I did these years ago, anxiety, overwhelmed, fear of judgment. These are things. So I'm in this fear state and I'm looking through these glasses, but I don't even see the beliefs anymore. All I do is just see what I always see. And these are the squiggly lines that I have to look in these clouded glasses. And that's just my world. And that's how I see it. And the concept with ACT therapy would be some diffusion. And what that means is that I'm going to actually decide to watch my thoughts. Now, that sounds kind of bizarre, but if you give space between your beliefs and your thoughts, and you just say that they're not really mine, they're my brain's, so I can choose and decide whether I want to think that or not. So I just take these glasses and I get some space between it, and now I can read it very clearly. It's not too close to me. So I've diffused this, okay? You are fused and you defuse, okay? So you're not fused to the way you're thinking anymore. You defuse and give space. And so I do this and I go, oh, well, okay. I don't have to be afraid of that, okay? I can choose not to be anxious in this moment. And so it gives you more power and you don't feel like you're controlled by your thoughts, but you can choose those things that you're going to listen to and to own or attach to, or you can decide that, no, that's just silly thought that my brain made up and I'm going to let it go. And so we let those things kind of slide off. The other thing, so that's kind of the idea of we don't have to be married, if you will, to our thoughts. The other thing that I love about ACT therapy, and it brings in values. Okay. So I do a lot of work with that. So in my workbooks, I do some values clarification. And we talk about this idea of being able to pivot toward or pivot away those things that are most important to us. And because we have a choice, we can pause and we can look at something and you can say, will this bring me closer to what's most important to me? Or will this take me farther away to what's most important to me? And will I pivot toward or will I pivot away from? Because all day long, that's all we're doing is we're pivoting toward or away or toward or away. And what happens if you pivot more toward your value system, your trajectory will go toward what's most important to you. We're not going to make the most perfect decisions all the time, but that's where we're talking about mostly. I always say there's not black and white, you know, it's always I'm mostly or sometimes, right? That got me out of my perfectionism. It's like I'm either mostly something or sometimes I don't do that. But mostly is what creates the outcomes of our life. It's not, you know, we don't have to always do something, but if we mostly do it. And so because we're just human. And so I help people with their pivot. I have this mantra that helps me and with this activity. And I say, will this bring me clarity of mind? Will this bring me energy of body? And will this bring me self-confidence? And that choice point, and if it will, then I will pivot toward that. Will that, or if it isn't, then I pivot away from it. So I always do that through that filter of that mantra. Because when I can tell you, when I was in my binge eating disorder, a fuzzy brain, right? I couldn't think very straight. I was tired all the time. And I felt really crappy about myself. And so that's why I love, to me, it's the clarity and energy. So I can show up today with enthusiasm and hopefully, you know, make some sense out of what I'm saying, where I would have been in a fog years ago if I was in my food. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that you're making total sense. And so much of what you're saying, I feel like we talk to our clients a lot about just maybe we use different words, but I think the concepts are absolutely the same as far as, you know, hey, if my brain is telling me this story that like, I'm awful, I'm lazy, whatever it might be, could it not also be equally true that the opposite, you know, could be the thing, you know, or whatever it might be. And I just really appreciate you sharing that idea of diffusion and how we can get some distance on that and like just get a new perspective. And I think so much of it probably resonates with myself and Clarissa. Again, you guys can't see us, but we're like bobbleheads over here because we are harm reduction clinicians. And we were wondering if you would talk to us a bit about a harm reduction approach to binge eating and loss of control eating. Yeah, any of that.
Yeah, this is something that I have adopted because what I have found is that the language in the addiction world, okay, is either abstinence or there's harm reduction. And so this is actually where this comes from for me, but I know I'm not new to this, but this from a food addiction perspective, I don't think abstinence, pure abstinence, works very well because of the food insecurity. I've seen people that have been, I don't know, I hate to call out any of them, but the programs for up to 10, 20 years and have weighed and measured their food and they have not strayed from the plan for that for years, some of them decades. But once they strayed, they're in my office and they're more out of control than they've ever been in their entire life. And I have watched this. So I've been in this field for 33 years and I have seen this over, I call them recovering abstinence people. And so I said, I believe that there's food addiction. And I believe that certain foods will light the brain up crazy making and create these sugar eating microbiome bacterias that says, calls up the vagus nerve, send me more of that sugar. That's the greatest thing in the world, right? I mean, I know that the more you eat of certain things in terms of the sugars or the simple carbohydrates and stuff, our brain and our gut just thrive on this stuff. It's just like, But how do you do this without causing food insecurity? Now, food insecurity, there's part of it is just genetic and in our DNA that we're afraid that we're going to die if we don't get something. But there also are these, and I do internal family systems as well. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but I believe that we have parts of us that are pretty rebellious and that they, when they're told no, absolutely not, they get restless. Okay. And so, and I don't know where that comes from. I'm not going to get philosophical or spiritual on you, but we all do. Everybody's got these rebellious parts. And so I feel we have to be kind to them and we have to calm them down and say, it's going to be okay. You know, if you want it, we can have it. But, you know, let's just look at this from more of a harm reduction kind of concept. So I always start people that are binging out of control first on a very structured food plan. And I try to, and I encourage them not to dose them themselves. I don't want them to dose them sugar or those types of things, because I don't like to use words like detox and all of that. But I just say, we've got to get the craving brain calmed down. We have to, you know, calm it. And we have to, and that part of us, the habitual brain, we need to pull that out. So it's going to create dysphoria for sure. Okay. It's not fun. But, and I warn them that anytime you have a habit and you stop the habit, the brain is going to make you feel crappy. It's actually going to take away the dopamine and make you feel dysphoria. So we'll get through this though, but highly structured. And so we're actually creating and training hunger. So a lot of people that are in binging, they binge a lot and then they're not hungry at all. And then they starve and then they binge. And so I try to get, you know, three meals, plate model, blah, blah, blah. And I also have them eat in a manner of balancing protein and carbohydrates so that their blood sugars are just as even as we can get them. And so with that, that's how we start. And we kind of get the body trained and get them unattached to some foods. Okay. The reason why I talk about harm reduction is that there is a time to reintroduce things. And I say there's a place for, and this comes from my own experience as well. There is a place for treats. I just got back from Hawaii. I've been on vacation. I was on a cruise when we stopped at all the islands. Yes, I'm a person of privilege. I just, my 20th anniversary, wedding anniversary, we were married in Hawaii. And so we just returned for our 20th anniversary. Well, these cruise ships, they have like soft serve ice cream 24/7. It's like, you can just have ice cream anytime you want. You can, you know, it's like, I watched people, but I like soft serve ice cream cones. And that's one of my kind of treat things. But this is what I have always said about those types of foods. Those foods are to eat mindfully and joyfully making memories. Those are not foods to be eating by yourself in the dark in front of the TV. Okay. Because those are the places that I ate those things. And so I always talk about when we start to reintroduce treats, we treat treats like treats. And we treat them when we're with others and that we're making memories. And so if somebody says, oh, I had blah, blah, blah. I said, were you making memories? And I said, I mean the good ones. Were you making good memories? Was this something of connection? Were you connecting with people? Was this? And were you able to eat a little bit of it and then throw the rest away? And if you can throw it away without thinking about the garbage can, okay, and when you're going to get back to the garbage can to pull it back out, then you're still hooked. And so let's not have it anymore. Okay. And so I do these exposure activities with my clients.
I feel like it's really important to name, though, that like for people listening, because so many people, like you said, in addiction treatment language, there's the abstinence model and the harm reduction model. And often harm reduction and moderation get conflated. And that's not what you're saying at all. You're not saying, hey, go moderate the ice cream or the treat. You're saying, do the harm reduction of you're not doing it in isolation. You're making sure that you're making the good memories. If you're eating a little bit and throwing the rest away, you're not going back to it. I just really want to call that out, name that, because I think what you're saying and describing is so important. So I apologize for interrupting. Continue. Yeah.
Yeah, no, thank you. Because it isn't about learning to eat things in moderation. Now, for instance, other people have people in their homes that eat things that they don't readily eat. And some people can do that. And some people, I mean, I can. There's stuff my husband, but sometimes it bugs me. I call it the hook. And if my brain starts thinking about it when I'm not hungry, I always say, honey, will you go put it in the freezer or the refrigerator out in the garage? Just that little bit of distance. It's like, will you just put it out there? Or like, if it's just something, if it starts to obsess or I start to think about it, I mean, and I've been in recovery for years, but if I start to think about it, then I know it, my brain got hooked. And I go, I don't like my brain being hooked. I don't like who I am when my brain gets hooked. I don't. And so I just say, I just need to do whatever I need to do to unhook it. Somebody gives me a present. Like I go and I speak places a lot. And sometimes they love in my hotel room. I come in and there's a basket and there's always a bunch of crap. Okay. It's like, they think that this is the greatest thing for me. You know what? I take it and I go and I take it downstairs to the lobby and I put it in the garbage can. Right. Or I give it to somebody because that's not a treat for me. Alone in my hotel room. Really? Now, if I'm going out with some colleagues and there happens to be something that I really, 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 really like, and I decide that I'm in a really good spot here, I might share and have a bite of something. But I can tell you, if I don't absolutely love it, I will not have any more. Why would I want to eat something that I absolutely didn't, you know, that's not going to be a sweet memory. And so it's like that. But let me tell you, I've got years under my belt. I can do this. There are some people that can't. But what I do with my clients is I do exposures with them.
Yeah. And that's harm reduction, right? And you're not saying, oh, everybody who is on an abstinent food plan and that's working for them, they need to go and try to find a way to introduce treats. You're saying like somebody who's been following this model and this model is not working for them anymore, that maybe this wasn't the exact right fit for them and they might benefit, their quality of life might improve if they look at a different way to treat their symptoms when their symptoms are showing up again. And I know in our field, even we are, because we're harm reduction clinicians, you know, we get pushback from the abstinence side sometimes. And, you know, the end goal of harm reduction in addiction is abstinence. But when the eating disorder world, I know it's different, but I've heard that there's a lot of backlash for harm reduction eating disorder clinicians. Do you experience the same? Why do you think that is?
Well, because I think there's so many people that feel all foods fit all the time. And that originally, if you think about mindful eating, intuitive eating, in fact, I have to say this, when I first started, in fact, the first book I wrote, right, in 2013 with Dr. Michelle May, and still it's a fabulous book. It's got lots of DBT and mindfulness. It's on mindfulness, mindful eating, and some structured eating in terms of questions and stuff. But I used to believe that you could just eat when you're hungry and stop when you're satisfied. And yet I've changed the way I look at things now. And I will not put somebody that is out of control, lost control eating and active binge eating disorder. I will not put them on intuitive eating. I will not put them on mindful eating. That's what we used to do 13 years ago. That is exactly what we did. And then we wondered why. They wondered why, because they don't have that interoceptive awareness. They don't understand hunger and fullness, not any more than somebody with anorexia. It's the same problem. And so, no, I don't do that anymore. And I think the end game is always intuitive and mindful. The end game, I mean, I don't think that the end game is people measuring, you know, weighing and measuring their food the rest of their life. In fact, I don't do that anymore. I use a plate model for structured eating, but because I think some people can be obsessive, can get obsessed with the solution. So I do start with structured eating, and the idea would be, but I still think that we have to be very careful with balancing our carbohydrates with our proteins. I think that more and more mental health, I'm thrilled with the direction that mental health is going, because they absolutely now are recognizing that actually food and people that are eating, you know, a standard American diet can have a full-blown panic disorder that can be corrected by eating properly. That now, you know, even at McLean Hospital with Dr. Parker, I don't know if you guys have heard about what they're doing with this, but they're actually believe that mental illness is an inflammatory disorder. And if you treat the inflammation and the metabolic disorder that's being caused by the food that people are eating, that they're actually, you know, getting better from chronic lifetime mental illness. And so, you know, brain is exploding here with finally people are realizing that what we put in our body and what we're eating is actually either making us sick or it's healing us. And the eating disorder world is not happy with this. I know that I'm going to be heard by my eating disorder colleagues, and I'm well known and respected, I believe, in this field. I've been in the field for a long, long time, but people know that I'm a little off on the fringes. Okay. But I think what they're going to find out is that I'm not the one on the fringes anymore, that what I've been talking about is true. I'm not talking about being skinny. I'm not talking about diet culture. I'm talking about health. And I don't believe that they always say that wellness is diet culture in sheep's clothing, you know, wolf in sheep's clothing. I think that people need to wake up and realize that health is that it doesn't, there's not like mental health is from the neck up and all other health is from the neck down. Our brain is an organ too. Our brain is an organ just like the other organs that are in our body, and we have to treat it well. That's me. I'm breaking up, breaking the molds here.
No, please do. I mean, I feel like we run on the fringe as well sometimes, but I mean, yeah, isn't it interesting? Like how, I don't know. I am a mental health professional, so I'm dual licensed mental health and addiction in Montana. And, you know, one of the things I like to say to my clients is, you know, one of the like markers that I look for in mental wellness, in the mental wellness world, is flexibility in thinking. And if we are so stuck in, you know, whatever silo it is or box we've decided is like our box, our label, our whatever, and we can't see beyond that, and we can't even have an open enough mind to believe that there could be other possibilities, that's rigidity. And that is a sign of potential problematic things happening. So I just appreciate your like standing in your truth, because I think that we do a lot of that, and we get pushback as well from our colleagues on all sides, because again, we work at that intersection. So we get pushback from both ends and from clients too. It's really interesting, which is fine. It's fine. I always welcome the pushback. I welcome the feedback. I thrive on that. But it is really interesting how that happens. So all of that aside, and you sharing all of this, we are really interested in hearing about the Safe and Sound protocol that you offer clients. And can you tell us what it is and how it works and who it's for?
Okay. Yeah. The Safe and Sound protocol is a vagus nerve activity, a stimulator. It's kind of like it's listening to music that has been filtered as such that it's like putting your vagus nerve on the treadmill on a fitness program. And so the vagus nerve is kind of like, sometimes it gets lazy and out of protection, it gets lazy, meaning that you tricked me once, can't trick me again. So it will not respond and calm you down. So let me tell you a little bit about the vagus nerve actually is when it stimulates, it puts the brakes on the sympathetic nervous system and calms you down from a fight flight, I'm going to protect you mode into an all is well mode. And so oftentimes it's slow to put the brakes on, especially people that have a history of traumatic experiences or things that have happened in their lives that they're going, you know, I put the brakes on and bad things happened. And so I'm not going to put the brakes on anymore. But what that does is it makes people very hypervigilant and anxious and super sensitive to lots of things. So essentially, Dr. Stephen Porges, he likes to be called Steve, he actually invented this. He started working with autism first. So these are individuals that are super sensory, like sound sensory, tactile sensory, sensitive, whatnot. And so with this, he did lots of experiments with this filter music. And what it did is it calmed down and made them more open to connecting, that people's voices and looking at people's eyes and connecting with others for these folks with autism wasn't as dangerous for them anymore. And they started to become much more animated and just fascinating. I got to see these before and after types of studies. Well, then they realized, well, if it's working with autism, he then did some stuff with Prader-Willi, which is really interesting too, because that has to do with binge eating. But then they started working with those with trauma backgrounds. But the titration with this type of therapy has to be so much more damped down. So for instance, I do like 8 different types of psychometric tests and things to try to find out how sensitive, including like the PTSD testing, ACE testing, different types of things to try to figure out, and then some stuff on sensory, how sensitive somebody is. And when I have somebody listen to this music to try to exercise their vagus nerve, I might have them on for 2 to 3 minutes where they're original at a time per day because they're so sensitive. Where when Stephen ended up doing this with people in the very beginning, they were like an hour a day for 5 days. And now we titrate it based on how sensitive the vagus nerve is. And that there's a real paradox that happens too, is that the body reacts and gets really kind of nervous when it calms down. So what happens is that when the vagus nerve starts to get more reactive, the whole nervous system like reacts and goes, oh no, this isn't good. And so then it kind of does this rebound and says, oh no, we don't want to be calm. Don't be calm. Right. And so we have to, it's, you know, that's why it takes somebody that's been trained to use this type of therapy, is that people can have some adverse reactions and kind of freaked out. And so we have to, but the thing that's fascinating is once we get it through this whole exercise, it's much more fit in terms of its reactivity. So it's really kind of fascinating. So it's sound therapy, but really it's a fitness program for the vagus nerve.
I love that because I could just so resonate with being someone who used to love thinking I thrived in sympathetic all the time until, you know, I did a lot of somatic work and befriended my body. And now I'm like, oh, actually parasympathetic is what feels good, but such a resistance to that because that felt too calm, too lazy, like maybe I might feel hungry, right? Sympathetic is a good way to turn off those hunger signals. So I love that there is these new waves coming out. I have a vagus nerve stimulator that I use sometimes that just makes my stomach growl like crazy. Like I just love these new techniques that are coming into play that are such helpful tools to help people regulate in a world that creates dysregulation all day long.
Yeah, it's scary to be calm. And so helping people to get used to that, that it's okay. But a lot of things change. I can remember when I had some sense of comfort when I overstuffed myself. And now it's just uncomfortable. It's like I can ruin a beautiful meal by overeating. And before that felt comfortable to me. So we can, you know, a lot of things change as we start to become safer.
Yeah. And I have to say, I really respected that you said, you know, I wrote that book a while ago. And at that time I had this, you know, idea about what it meant to be an eating disorder professional and how I treated people. And then over years working with people, I've realized that there are other ways. I mean, I certainly can, I think both Molly and I started in our field one way, and we have, you know, evolved after working with so many people and them teaching us what they needed. And it helps us become better professionals. And I think there are a lot of professionals that get set in through that one lens that, like, this is the way it works and this is the only way to do it. So I do know that since you wrote that first book, you recently wrote another book and you have a workbook. Can you share with our listeners, like, what is that book about? Who is it for? And would it be something that maybe they might be interested in?
Yeah. So my memoir is A Food, Body, and Love, but the greatest of these is love. And that was the original book that came out in 2021. And essentially, it does tell my story. And it says how I finally came kind of full circle and had this epiphany or realization of, oh, I know why I have an eating disorder. And thinking that, you know, I've been treating eating disorders for 20 years before I wrote this book, right? And now I'm finally going, oh, I think I understand why I had an eating disorder and I get it now. And so that's what that was about. And it really is a body-based, and it goes in the whole middle section of talks about all the neurology and the biology behind the what I truly believe that's happening. And then the last section is all about love. Now, for me, there's a real spiritual thread with this. I believe that we're meant to be in a state of love and calm, and we're not supposed to be afraid. And so essentially, love is a state of non-fear. And so it talks about how do we live in a state of non-fear, that we're meant to connect with others. And it really talks about, it's through the lens of the polyvagal theory. The entire book is about this idea that we're meant to be connected to other people. And what fear does is isolates us. And so we have to, as we're healing our fear, which is our protectors. And I believe eating disorder is just a disorder of fear. I truly believe it is, because it's very protective and it works. You know, the thing is that it's not a terrible, awful thing. I think we get to the point where we don't need to be protected anymore, and that I'm ready and I can move out of this. But at the time I needed it, I needed it. And so I don't think of anything as bad. It's just that it's overused, and it can then make things even worse for ourselves. So that it's my story. And then the workbook, which people are just loving. I'm so excited that I did it. But essentially, they said, could you make this operational? Can you say, actually, like all these little things that you can do in terms of activities? And I have solutions up the yin yang, meaning solutions would be skills and strategies. And it takes people through 8 different chapters, if you will, they're sections. And it goes through each from everything from dealing with trauma and the nervous system and befriending the nervous system and mapping the nervous system to relationships, to body image, to movement. I have a nourish section that really explains the plate model of balancing carbs and proteins and how you can keep yourself calm. And so there's just loaded with stuff, and people really are liking it. So that makes me happy. And it's just called, the way you find it is, Food, Body, and Love Companion Workbook.
Great. So where can our listeners find you?
You can find me. I'm easy to find. My website is myeatingdoctor.com, spelled out myeatingdoctor.com, myeatingdoctor.com. And then I also have everything, like if you go to Amazon, is Food, Body, and Love. I don't sell my books off my website. I just send people to Amazon. I let them take care of it. And so you can find all my stuff. You can search Dr. Carrie Anderson on Amazon, or you can do Food, Body, and Love, and my stuff will pop up.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'm excited to get my hands on a workbook. So we always have a signature question for our guests, and we try to tailor it for each individual person. So for you, Dr. Anderson, if you could tell a younger version of yourself something about eating disorders, disordered eating, binge eating disorder, and recovery from it all, what would you tell that version of you?
I would say, Carrie, little Carrie, you don't have to be afraid of food. Food is a healer. It is medicine. That food is not something that you need to be afraid of at all. And so, I just think that our culture tries to make people, and young people especially, afraid of food and they make it about, you know, calories in and calories out and stuff. And that's just it. Food is so much more. It's medicine. And so I just wish that I wouldn't have been afraid of it. And so I would have brought myself up to really think about food as something that's a healer.
That's a great answer. And I can so relate to that as well. Thank you so much, Dr. Anderson, for being here today. We'll put all your show notes and like links to your stuff so our audience can access your materials. And it's just been so delightful chatting with you today.
Well, thank you for having me. And thanks for letting me go on and on and on about stuff. So yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us this week on Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. Make sure to join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life Support Group, I'm Sweet Enough. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or Stitchers. That way you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Don't forget to pick up your copy of Dr. Tarman's book, Food Junkies, which is available on Amazon. If you have any additional questions, both Molly and Clarissa are food addiction professionals and work one-on-one with clients. You can find their websites and email addresses in the show notes. Be sure to tune in every Friday when our new episodes drop. As Vera loves to say, the power is ours.